Today at Reader's Corner, we talk to Matthew Restall, author of When Montezuma Met Cortez, the true story of the meeting that changed history. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. On November 8, 1519, the Spanish conquistador, Hernando Cortez, first met Montezuma, the Aztec emperor. This introduction, the prelude to the Spanish seizure of Mexico City and to European colonization of the mainland of the Americas, has long been the symbol of Cortez's bold and brilliant military genius. Montezuma, on the other hand, is remembered as a coward who gave away a vast empire and touched off a wave of colonial invasions across the hemisphere. But is that what actually happened? In his book, When Montezuma Met Cortez, Matthew Restall offers a dramatic rethinking of the encounter between Montezuma and Hernando Cortez that completely overturns what we know about the Spanish conquest of the Americas. Matthew Restall is a historian of colonial Latin America. He is the author of a dozen essays and 20 books, including seven myths of the Spanish conquest, The Conquistadors, and The Black Middle. An award-winning writer, author, and Guggenheim Fellowship winner, Restall is the director of Latin American Studies at Penn State University. Matthew Restall, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob.
So I bet you've never been called this before, Matthew, but you strike me in higher education these days, everybody's talking about innovation and disruptive innovation. You seem to be the disruptive innovator of the history department.
I love that. You're right. No one has ever called me a disruptive innovator, but I think I might add that to my email signature or something.
There you go. Your book is such a fascinating reconsideration of something that so many of us took for granted and just read what we read and assumed it was all true. It would be difficult for Americans to miss the controversy, in recent years anyway, about the myths and realities of the original narrative of Columbus, quote, discovering America, unquote. We're not as well-versed on the Spanish conquest of the Americas. Could you just kind of start with giving us a capsule summary of what the Spanish Empire looked like in 1492, or more importantly, in 1504, when Cortez first landed, I believe, he might have landed in Cuba, not Mexico. He wound up in Mexico later. What were Spain's designs on the Americas at that time?
That's a great question, Bob, and anyone who's listening to this, who teaches this, any history professors will laugh because they'll know that they spend weeks answering that question. It is in 1492 or in 1504 when Cortez first arrived in the Caribbean. Not only did the Spanish Empire not exist, but Spain did not exist. So Spain was just coming into being through a complex process of conquest and dynastic expansion in Europe. And at the same time, as part of that process of expansion in Europe, there's expansion in the Americas. But it's not crown-directed. Because Spain is only just coming into being, it's not a powerful central state. So these expeditions in the Americas by Spaniards who end up becoming not just explorers, but conquistadors and then settlers, those expeditions are being put together and carried out as companies of individual investors and people who have been recruited and signed on. You know, the Spanish word compañía sort of evokes the English word company, which makes us think of an enterprise or a business enterprise, and that's not a bad way of thinking about it. I've called the conquistadors armed entrepreneurs in the past, and I think that is a kind of a useful phrase that holds up. So it's very easy for that to be misconstrued and thereby to think of them as bands of motley adventurers, that kind of thing. There's a kind of a swashbuckling, almost romantic, piratical image that emerges, right? That these larger-than-life figures, just a few in hundred, are able to charge around the Americas, conquering whole empires and so on. And that's one of the misconceptions and myths, one of the legends that I'm trying to undo in this book.
Mm-hmm. And in your previous book, I mentioned it in the introduction, Seven Myths of the Spanish Conquest. I think at one point you said something like you wanted people to understand the Spanish conquest of the Americas as an episode in the globalization of access to resources of food production. So what role does food production play here?
Yeah, and there's a larger story that is incredibly important in human history. It's difficult to overstate it because it's the story that contains the episodes that lead to the foundation and then the creation of the world that we live in today. That there were two halves of the planet in human terms, and also in terms of flora and fauna, bacteria, and so on. And those two halves of the world are not actually mathematically halves, but the two parts did not connect. The human beings did not know about each other. And once those two meet, then globalization is possible. And they meet through the process of European imperialization. So globalization, therefore, happens in a relatively rapid and violent way. And in order to understand pretty much any aspect of the 21st century, this is the moment you have to go back to. In fact, I would argue a good place to start would be the meeting of Cortez and Montezuma, which sounds like a way to promote my book, but I guess that's what we're talking about.
Exactly. That's what we want to talk about.
Yeah, this isn't just one of the great meetings of human history, bringing together two empires, two civilizations. There's nothing like this before or since. And in fact, there can never be any meeting like this ever again in human history. The next closest thing we could get to is encounter with aliens, life forms from other planets. Once these two civilizations are brought together, once Europeans and Africans and Native Americans know about each other and that process begins, then globalization is inevitable.
How much did each of those parties, that is Montezuma and Cortez, know about each other?
Nothing. The short answer is nothing.
Yeah.
There was no, in the kind of larger scale of it, they didn't know anything.
Mm-hmm.
They had all kinds of preconceptions of what that meant, but they didn't know anything. And in the shorter term, they knew something because Montezuma had been observing Spaniards sailing up and down the coast. He knew they had landed years earlier, further down in the Maya area. So they knew something. And Spaniards had developed ideas, mostly sort of wrongheaded and prejudicial, as you might expect, to the early 16th century, about the Aztecs as this category that the Spaniards had invented, which is Indians, right? So they kind of lumped them all together in a kind of a fairly barbarous and negative category of Indians. So they had some ideas, but essentially they didn't know anything. Now, that can be taken too far, and one of the great myths that is still out there and persists about this encounter is that native peoples were a little bit primitive in their thinking, and when they saw Spaniards or other Europeans with the technology that they brought, they thought, oh, these must be gods, right? They can't be humans. They must be special creatures, supernatural or something like that. I think that's terribly wrong, and that takes us down one of those old dangerous paths in which the encounter is between civilization and barbarism.
So tell us a little bit about the Aztec Empire and putting this in context. What was Montezuma ruling over? How sophisticated was this empire compared to the European side of the pond, so to speak?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think the beginning point for thinking about that is not to try and think about which of these two civilizations was more advanced or more sophisticated or more complex, but rather to see them as being more or less on an equal footing in those terms, and then for us to them to be able to explore similarities and differences. So obviously, Spaniards brought with them certain kinds of technologies that allowed them to get there, like sailing ships, that Aztecs did not have. On the other hand, the Aztec Empire was, by any reckoning, a more impressive political organization than Spain was at that point, Spain barely existing. And the city that outside of which this meeting took place in 1519, the capital, Aztec capital of Tenochtitlan, was, I think, if we had gone back in time and we could visit it and then hop in our time machine across to Europe and look at European cities, I think we would all agree that that was a more impressive, more spectacular city than any city in Europe. It was larger than any city in Europe, or very similar to the largest city in Europe in terms of the population on the island itself. But the population all around the lake, so the larger sort of metropolitan area, was larger than any other city in the Americas, any city in Europe or Africa, comparable only to the largest cities in China at the time. And in order to, for such a city to function of that size, it had to be very well organized, and it was beautifully laid out, straight streets, straight canals. The Spaniards were absolutely gobsmacked, as they say in England. They were amazed and terrified, because they realized, hang on a sec, this is a huge, really well-organized city. This must be therefore a well-organized, high-functioning political unit, an empire. We may have bitten off more than we can chew here. We may be in big trouble.
So let's talk about the meeting between Cortes and Montezuma. If you could give us the traditional narrative, and then what your research over the years has produced in the counter history, if you can call it that.
Yeah, this is kind of the really exciting part for me and why I wrote the book. As we approach this quincentennial of this meeting and the Spanish-Aztec War, some editors at presses asked if I was interested in writing a book about it, and I said, no, I don't have anything else new to say. It's already all been said. There's so many books about it. They said, well, you can come up with some kind of angle, and I started doing some research into some aspects of it to see if there was something, and I found something. I came to a realization that was far more dramatic than I had possibly expected, and that is this. I've already mentioned that this meeting is unique in human history, incredibly important sort of milestone moment. But then I realized what's really astonishing about it. I think the most astonishing thing is that the characterization and description of that meeting for the last 500 years has been dramatically wrong. And it's this: about a year after the meeting, the Spaniards began to put out the story that the meeting was a surrender. The earliest written down version we have of it was written by Cortes himself in what very quickly becomes a famous letter to the king, in which he describes Montezuma as simply giving up without a fight, just surrendering the kingdom. And not only that, but doing it in this kind of legalistic way, recognizing the sovereignty of the Spanish crown. I mean, it's a ludicrous idea. It's completely implausible. It obviously didn't happen, but at the same time, it's very easy to see how it was very important after the fact for the Spaniards to be able to provide a simple legalistic justification for everything that they do in Mexico and Central America. And amazingly, it sticks. It sticks for hundreds of years. And that's as much a part of my book as the telling of the events in 1519 through 1521 itself. The idea is that the reader learns what happened, learns of what that traditional story is given my argument, which hopefully they find persuasive, that that was not what happened, that Montezuma did not surrender. And then what's really important is that the reader understands why it is that lie survived for another 500 years. And there are many different reasons, and the book is long, but the bottom line is that it's a version of the same lie that underpins European imperialism that takes over the whole world. Mm-hmm. Pretty much, you know, as you go forward through hundreds of years, European empires stretch over and subdue or attempt to subdue almost every corner of the globe. And the idea that that's a legitimate process is obviously extremely important. Well, not anymore, right? Yeah. We can revisit all of that, and we can undo all of that and better understand what really happened. Now, then that I know where you're, I know, Bob, where you're thinking. It's like, okay, if he didn't surrender, then what did he do? Why did he?
Right.
He obviously welcomed Cortez into the city. So why did he do that? Well, we have to try not to look at that moment from the point of view of our knowledge of what happens in the succeeding hundreds of years, our knowledge of how Native Americans, there's nothing that they can do to the onslaught of Europeans and their African slaves and so on, that kind of onslaught from the old world is unstoppable. It's easy for us in hindsight to see it that way, but if you imagine Montezuma, he is the ruler of a powerful empire. His city is spectacular. There are millions of people in this empire. He has many thousands of warriors at his disposal, and the Spanish are just a few hundred. Of course, that's part of the legend that gets turned around into an amazing conquest. But from his point of view, they don't really represent much of a threat. And in fact, they're not. So he welcomes them in as sort of guests. And the metaphor that I use in the book, and it's sort of semi-metaphorical, is that he's a zookeeper, he's a collector. That Montezuma had an enormous network of palaces and gardens and zoos where he kept animals and of all kinds, even human beings with deformities, flora and fauna of every kind. And he, I think, conceptually sees these invaders in that same way. Let's put them in a palace right next to mine. He's thinking, he puts them in his late father's palace, old palace, and I want to learn about them. And he spends his days with them, talking and studying and so on. It's just an absolutely fascinating period. It lasts something around 235 days, which is a long time. And we don't know much about that time period because most of the Spaniards who were there, and there were only a couple of hundred, didn't survive the war that then consumes the area for the following year. And most of the Spaniards who are alive at the end of that war were not there during the city. They come in subsequently. There were not the whole war of 2.5 years. There were not only 300 or 400 Spaniards. There were more like 3,000. So it's a little bit more complicated than the numbers usually given. So during those months, Montezuma is studying his Spaniards, if you like. That's really this fascinating moment where I wish I could go back in my time machine and be in Tenochtitlan during those months and see how that the meeting, which we think of as this as one day, is really something that stretches out over many months of cultural contact.
You're listening to Matthew Restall. He's the author of When Montezuma Met Cortez, the true story of the meeting that changed history. So the arts and many people outside of the official historians play a pretty obvious role in defining this history over 300 or 400 years and misleading, I guess you could say, anybody trying to get to the bottom of this. Could you, in fact, you have some beautiful renditions of art in your book. And I noticed that in one particular case, it even, it's applauding the work of Cortez. It's the art of the day is celebrating Cortez as this great hero. And Hollywood even managed to get into the act with Cesar Romero. Maybe you want to address this issue of how this was more than just a handful of official historians recreating a tale.
Yes, that's very important because otherwise it starts to seem as if I'm arguing there's some kind of a conspiracy, right? Yeah. That historians are all kind of getting together and copying each other or towing the party line. And it's much more than that. It is part of the larger culture, the way in which, I mean, it sounds sort of grandiose, but the way in which our civilization, Western civilization, or what ultimately becomes kind of a global civilization, sees this moment and moments like it. And therefore, we can trace how it is presented in all the media, cultural media of expression that evolve over the hundreds of years since it happened, which means, initially it is chronicles and history books with fairly simple illustrations. But as we move through the centuries, it becomes manifest and expressed in operas, in public art, one of the places where it's found, which absolutely fascinated me, is the U.S. Capitol building in Washington, D.C., where I was lucky enough to spend several months on a fellowship there studying the art in that building. And I was amazed at how blatant that version of the story is as presented in artwork in that building, from which millions of Americans, literally millions of Americans, visit and see that every year, kind of perpetuating this particular image of surrender. And therefore, when people play a video game, turn on Netflix, I think there's a Steven Spielberg produced upcoming Netflix drama about Cortez and Montezuma. I think it's called Montezuma. It used to be called Cortez. I think they changed the name to Montezuma, but I'm not sure about that. I think we're getting that coming up next year. And so when people watching that see this as a surrender, it makes sense to them. It's sort of part of the way in which that moment has been conveyed. And I'm always amazed at how, when I bring this up with Penn State undergraduates where I teach, and I start by saying, do you know anything about this history? And they say, no, we don't know anything. That's why we're taking the class. But when we push it a little bit, it turns out they do. On some level or another, they do. They have this idea that what's amazing about this moment in history is just a small number of Spaniards conquering an empire of millions, and that there was this leader or emperor or whatever he was, they're not sure who just kind of gave up. He gave up because they have some understanding that on some level, this was an inevitable process, and he accepted that inevitability. And I think that's the sort of the really problematic part of how this idea is out there in the larger culture and needs to be addressed, not just because it's something that's wrong in history, but because it has larger implications for how we view other civilizations and cultures, how we view the relationship between different peoples and nations in the Americas, for example. And I think in a few steps, we can sort of bring it up to date and make it part of our debate about how we are going to treat each other in this hemisphere in the 21st century.
Well, it also seems to me, after reading your book, that it raises the question of how many other great examples are there over the centuries of interpreting major historical periods or events that we get wrong.
And there must
be a lot of PhD dissertations heading our way over the years, because what I think your work really does in the history discipline is alert graduate students that there's some real produce here to mine if you're willing to get there.
Yes, I agree. I love that you went in that direction. That's the direction I want people to go in. And I think also, you know, a lot of people out there are thinking, well, yes, of course there are, and we already know that. And maybe there's someone who's going to write a dissertation, but there are also people who already written those dissertations, right, or those books. And I already made that argument about this other moment or this moment. And so I think, in addition to the point that you're making, the other point is, yes, but how do we share that information with larger audiences? How's that conveyed? I mean, if I'm right, and this has been a lie that's survived in thousands of ways over 500 years, then my little book is not going to change everything, right? Not on its own. It's only going to change things if other people investigate, repeat, say it again. Yes, probably, you know, steal the ideas. I mean, you mentioned my 7 Myths of the Spanish Conquest book. You can find those exact same ideas online in other people's classes and lectures and so on, where the concepts of it and the specific ideas have just been taken without giving credit to me. And people say, oh, aren't you mad about that? Like, no, not at all. On the contrary,
right.
That's what you want. You want your ideas to be validated and investigated and repeated. And if people are taking the idea that Montezuma did not surrender and applying it to other moments in human history and dismantling them in the same way, then that's more than I could possibly hope for, right? In addition, of course, to talking to you, Bob.
So I have to ask you, I mentioned Cesar Romero in the movie Captain from Castile. I don't remember ever seeing that. I doubt that I did. But I'm just curious as to your take. Did Cesar Romero portray this swashbuckling hero that is all part of the original narrative?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was very, very swashbuckling and and amusing. And, you know, that's a great movie to use in the classroom to have students see what the misconceptions and cliches and stereotypes are. And in fact, that movie ends before the meeting. Oh. The very end of the movie is Cortez galloping across the field with the other conquistadors going to Tenochtitlan to meet Montezuma. And that's where the movie ends. And I don't know this for sure. It's a very old movie, but I suspect they realized they could not possibly recreate Tenochtitlan back in those days before CGI technology. Now, of course, they can. So now there is not a technological barrier to recreating or attempting to accurately recreate that meeting in Tenochtitlan. And I hope those people who have that technology at their disposal do that before too long.
So there was a 2015 movie about Cortez as well. What did that do to his reputation?
All the movies so far contribute to the kind of to the legend of Cortez, even if they portray him in a negative way. The movies, the television series, there's been some Spanish television series as well. And I think this is one of the things I battled with in my book. It is a book which argues that Cortez is not important, and yet he's in the title, he's on the cover, and he's on almost every page. And I realize that there's kind of a contradiction and a sort of a problem that in a way I never really found a way to resolve. He's kind of the elephant that's in the room the whole time. And I think that it's going to require more work by other historians. And indeed, that work is already being done by many gifted historians in the United States and in Mexico to help us to understand the roles played by other Spaniards and also by other indigenous leaders so that there's a way in which we can kind of eclipse him, right? Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of television drama and movies, you want to be able to tell a great story in, let's say it's a movie in 2 hours. That's hard to do if you're going to try to recreate, say, my long book in movie form. And that's one of the arguments that I make in the book as to why this traditional narrative has survived, because it follows the classic arc of a story that has been central to how we tell stories in our civilization for hundreds of years. And the parallel that I make more in lectures and less in the book, because it can be very easily misconstrued, and that is that it's the same story arc of a romantic comedy movie. It's the rom-com, boy meets girl, everything's going great, then there's some kind of misunderstanding, everything falls apart, but then it's all okay at the very end and they get back together. That's the traditional narrative that's so terribly wrong of the meeting of Cortez and Montezuma. They are the boy and girl. They meet. Everything's okay, right? There's no fighting. Everything's fine. And then there's some kind of misunderstanding. War breaks out. According to the traditional narrative, the Aztecs kill Montezuma themselves because they see him as a traitor. I argue the Spaniards murdered him, but anyway, and then there's a terrible war, and then everything is, in the traditional narrative, all right at the end, because the Spaniards then reconquer the city, they claim the empire, they're victorious, civilization triumphs over barbarism, the true faith is implanted, and so on. So it's a rom-com narrative. Mm-hmm. So of course it works. If you're making a movie, it's perfect. You know your audience, without realizing it, are going to know what's happening. They're going to be comfortable and familiar with that story arc. But unfortunately, reality isn't a rom-com movie. It's a lot more messy and a lot more disturbing.
What impact did the Spanish expeditions have on indigenous life in the Americas? And when they did arrive, they came not just with Spaniards, I understand, but you might also comment on the slaves that they brought along. I think they may have come from Cuba. We oftentimes don't focus on that part of the story.
No, we don't. And So two different levels of slave raiding and enslaving that is going on. First of all, there's extensive slave raiding happening all over the Caribbean. And so Spaniards are bringing with them hundreds, ultimately thousands of indigenous peoples from the Caribbean who've been taken as slaves into the mainland. And they're also bringing slaves from Africa. And the expansion of the sub-Saharan African slave trade up into Europe had already happened a couple of generations before Columbus. And so at the time of this war now, you're already about 80 years into that process. So very quickly, increasing numbers of African slaves are being brought over into the mainland. So there are Africans and people of African descent who are participating in this process, in this war, as fighters, as settlers. Some of them are free, have always been free. Some are slaves and then become free as a result of that process. So we talk about Spaniards and Spanish conquistadors, but actually fighting on that side of the war is an incredibly complex ethnic mixture of peoples. And something we haven't talked about so far, which is really important, is that the vast majority of people fighting against the Aztecs are indigenous. That the Spaniards are outnumbered many, many, many times over by other indigenous people. And in fact, it's not just an uprising of subjects of the Aztecs, which is how when the Spaniards conceded that there were indigenous allies fighting with them. That's how they saw it, as the subjects, former subjects of the Aztecs, rising up against their hated oppressors, is how the Spaniards saw it. In fact, it's far more complex than that, and that their presence initiates a kind of civil war within the Aztec Empire, or a division within the empire in which, not to get too ensnared in the details here, but the leaders of the second biggest and second most important city in the empire, Texcoco, right on the banks of the lake there, facing the island city of Tenochtitlan. So the leaders of that city ally themselves with the Spaniards, use the Spaniards, and I think we should see it from their point of view as them taking the Spaniards as their allies in order to change that balance of power. So they then become the number one city in the empire, not Tenochtitlan. And so from their point of view, they are using Spaniards to change that balance of power and not destroy the empire, but make the empire centered on them. So if we switch from perspective, it becomes more complicated and harder to follow, but it becomes so much more interesting and makes so much more sense.
Well, Matthew, we've run out of time, but our listeners certainly have a lot to think about here. And again, the first thing they need to do is realize they can find it in When Montezuma Met Cortez, The True Story of the Meeting That Changed History by Matthew Restall, and also Seven Myths of the Spanish Conquest, which I just ordered. I think that has a 2004 publication date, but it's as relevant to our conversation today as it was then. And Matthew Restall, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you to everyone who's listening.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.